Hi, I'm Chloe McCulloch, Editorial Director for Building Magazine and Housing Today. And this is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast looking at the housing crisis, brick by brick. Your presenters for this series are two people well-placed to break down the issues around Britain's broken housing market. Peter Bill?
Yes, I'm Peter. I used to be important. But before I was important, I worked for 20 years in the building trade as a QS. Half of that time working for a house builder. I then moved on into journalism. Years ago, I edited Building Magazine, and slightly fewer years ago, I edited the Estates Gazette magazine. A bit later than that, writing a book called Planet Property, and a bit later than that, writing a book called Broken Homes, Solving Britain's Housing Crisis.
And Jackie Sadek.
Yes, I'm Jackie, and I've spent way over 40 years in the property development and urban regeneration industry. I started my career at the London Docklands Development Corporation. I've worked for private sector developers, I've worked in the public sector, both for local authorities and for government agencies, and I ended up as a government advisor. After coming out of government, I then co-wrote Broken Homes with the aforementioned Peter Bill.
Peter and Jackie will be pulling no punches, either with each other or with the high-profile guests they'll be talking to each week about how we provide the housing the country needs to thrive.
Actually, what we do need is a very radical rethink about how we provide housing in this country. And it's affecting everything we do. It's affecting our entire economy.
Houses are built by house builders to make money. And if they can't make any money, they stop building them like they did last year. So we thought it would be worthwhile exploring this issue. It seems to be terribly important to everybody, but there seems to be no answers.
So keep listening for the thoughts and ideas of key people from across the housing sector in this pivotal election year.
This is Home Truths,
a Building Talks podcast.
Hello, Peter, and hello, everybody, and welcome to this latest edition of Home Truths. Wonderful to be back in the room together again.
It certainly is, really. And today, we have Toby Lloyd. Toby is an interesting character who's a sort of academic who ended up at Shelter on housing and produced some very interesting reports and managed to persuade Shelter to do stuff that the Tories might like to do, which I think was a bit of a coup for him. And he produced such a nice report that the Tories took him on, and he ended up in number 10 as an advisor and did some very good work there. And Toby's one of these guys that when you ask him a question that you think you know the answer to, he comes up with a different answer which somehow convinces you that he's right and you're wrong.
Well, he has got a blinding intellect and is highly regarded in the sector, and every time I'm with him he just blows me away really with his analysis. I mean, I only understand about one word in three, but I do think he really has a forensic grip on what needs to happen. And for various reasons and showing our age now, Peter, we're going to call this episode Gimme Shelter.
That's a nice title for it, really. Shelter was one of the first organisations ever set up to look after poor people. And what we will be talking about mainly is the council housing end of things. We're gradually coming to the conclusion that something needs to be done about housing the poor.
So we last interviewed Toby for our book, Broken Homes, and I think he totally impressed us then. And subsequently, he's gone on to do some fantastic things. So having left his post as policy director of Shelter, he then went into number 10 as Mrs May's housing advisor, as you know. And then he came out of there and is now working with Nicholas Boyes-Smith and others and is still very much prominent in the housing debate and a very highly regarded housing analyst, so much so that national news outlets get him on fairly regularly to give an input to the housing crisis debate.
This is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast.
Well, it's good to see you again. I think the last time we met was at the Reform Club just before COVID closed the world down. I think what we'd like to do to start with is just to talk about your time a little bit at Shelter and the report you did for them, and then a little bit of your time at number 10 and how things were going on the housing front before they stopped going with a change of Prime Minister. So just a bit about, if you could just start off with what you're doing at Shelter and on the housing front.
Well, I worked for Shelter as head of policy and then head of housing development for 7 years. So I wrote an awful lot of policy reports for Shelter on lots of different topics, from homelessness to private rented sector regulation to house building to welfare benefits to you name it, because Shelter obviously covers a huge range of housing issues, and I was there for quite a long time. But I think what you're referring to is the work I really focused on housing supply. Shelter is a campaign organisation first and foremost, so it exists to change government policy. Its entire mechanism for achieving change is to leverage public opinion in order to change government policy. So our focus was very much on designing public policy and then communicating it to government in such a way so that they would change public policy towards housing. I stand by that as an approach, because the housing sector is overwhelmingly determined by government in various ways, whether it's through the benefit system, the planning system, tenure law, mortgage regulation, the homelessness legislation. There's a huge number of different ways in which government shapes the housing system as a whole. So even if you're not expecting government to literally pay for everything, and I don't think anyone is, you still require government to be on side if you're trying to achieve any systemic change in the housing system. So Shelter's work was very, very much aimed at governments. Obviously, I was working for them in a period of Conservative-led governments. So that was necessary. And, of course, during the years of austerity. So this was inherently a challenging time for the sector and for the homelessness lobby organisations like Shelter. So we spent a lot of work trying to work out, firstly, you know, what is the right policy prescription? This is very much my brief, but also critically, the political message. How do we sell this to a Conservative government? And our experience was that in the run-up to the 2015 election, we had a lot of success in getting housing up the agenda. We felt that we'd been a part of, and couldn't claim it all to ourselves, but we'd certainly put a lot of work and effort into making housing one of the top issues for that election. And it was, you know, we monitored the opinion trackers very carefully, and housing was up there as a kind of third or fourth most important issue in most of the polls, which we felt was a great success. Unfortunately, despite having achieved that, the result was a Conservative government that came in and introduced what, to Shelter's eyes, was a disastrous Housing Act. The 2015 Housing Act, which was in many ways, we thought, exactly the opposite of what was required, was a big attack on council housing. They were going to forcibly sell off a large amount of council housing in order to fund, it's a complicated cross-subsidy mechanism, the forced selling off of housing association housing. Through extending the right to buy, which had long been a kind of Conservative policy dream, and various other policies which we felt were deeply unhelpful. So we went kind of back to the drawing board and thought, you know, how has it come to this? How have we managed to get housing up the agenda and influence the government, and yet not actually influence them in the way we wanted? So I put a lot of work into recalibrating a lot of the policy analysis we'd done before and how we presented it to be more appealing to a Conservative audience. And some of that was kind of bluntly kind of cheap comms gimmicks. I mean, changing the colour. You know, Shelter's outputs are all covered in screaming red kind of socialist banners. And the kind of the language and the photos. The images in Shelter's reports tend to be, it reflects what it is. It's kind of an urban left-wing kind of social campaign organization, and it just instinctively, intuitively doesn't speak the same language as most Conservative MPs do. So some of it was just cheap tricks. I changed the color on the report from red to barber jacket green, and the photos, we'd use a lot of photos of Prince Charles's Duchy of Cornwall developments at Poundbury and Nansladen and other places to try and get across the point that actually we're not here to talk about tower blocks or, you know, brutalist architecture. In fact, Shelter is completely architecture neutral. What we care about is getting a system that enables more people to be housed better.
It was very good to hear you talk about the housing policy of 2015. You might recall I was in government working in CLG at the time of that policy, and It ruined one Christmas for me, actually, as we were trying to deal with the fallout of this terrible, terrible PR disaster where then government advisors were writing op-eds for the then Prime Minister talking about concrete slabs. And people were finding it quite deeply offensive, you know, when they talk about their own communities and their own homes in these really quite pejorative sort of ways. And I'm just wondering what then, you know, as you did this wonderful work at Shelter and you made Shelter look, you know, vaguely appealing to the Conservative government, how then did it come about that you were brought into the heart of government, went into number 10 as the housing advisor to Mrs. May? How did all of that work? And then when you formed that fantastic axis with Gavin Barwell, can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, as a result of doing this work to try and kind of reposition the branding of Shelter's policy output, we were able to get an interview with the new team in the number 10 operation. This was following the 2017 general election when Theresa May had been forced to kind of clear out her entire advisor team and bring in Gavin Barwell. And James Marshall as head of policy. So we went in and gave this pitch to James Marshall. And the next day he phoned me up and asked me to come and join the government. So, you know, it showed that there was clearly a willingness on government to listen, which is not always the case. So, you know, the first rule of influencing success is to get lucky. And we clearly got lucky. But I'd like to think it was also partly because we had made a conscious effort to make the message more appealing to that audience. But critically, you know, we never changed the fundamental analysis. The analysis was exactly the same as I've been banging on about for years, even before I joined Shelter, that the problem with the housing system wasn't just a kind of lack of subsidy or, sclerotic planning, although both of those could be, you know, blamed. The real problem was a fundamental misunderstanding of the way the land market works and a kind of surrendering to economic rent extraction that drove dysfunction on every single level. And until we were prepared to grapple with that, we would never really get to the bottom of the housing crisis. And there seemed, briefly at least, to be a willingness to entertain that idea.
Is this around the time that Oliver Letwin did his... were you involved in the Letwin thing?
It was indeed. And I fed into Oliver Letwin's research and to his recommendations a lot. And I thought that was another indication that there was a real willingness to kind of ask the big questions and even, you know, at least entertain some radical ideas for reform. And in the end, I think his proposals didn't quite go as far as his own analysis suggested was necessary. And in any case, they were never taken forward by government anyway. But I thought his analysis was spot on. And I would say that because it was very much the same as my own.
What about the stuff on space standards and things like that? Just briefly on that, you did some work on that, I gather.
Yes, I mean, it's as part of that whole critique of surrendering housing policy entirely to the market. It's very obvious that that will always drive down standards, because the inherent nature of competition will mean that spaces will get smaller and more cramped, and people will be forced to, you know, squeeze more and more people into the same and smaller homes. So yes, I was always in favour of stronger space standards. That said, there's always up against the headwinds of a government that repeated governments who've been desperate to get housing supply numbers up while also cleaving to an ideology of deregulation and, you know, and free market libertarianism ultimately. And unfortunately, in that context, there is always a temptation to go for anything that promises we can just get a bit of a quick boost. And the easiest way to do that, in fact, the only successful way that governments of the last 14 years have found, was permitted development rights. So just allowing more conversions and more deregulation of conversions, which unfortunately drove down standards so sharply and so dramatically that they were forced to recognize that there was a need for basic space standards and at least like basic rules about things like having windows in houses. So perversely, it was the very success of their PDR policy that drove some interest in space standards for the first time.
Finally, on the space standards thing, do you think that the ones that we have now, which are, you know, quite low, should be improved?
Yes, I do. I do. I don't think there's, we can argue about exactly where the numbers should be. I think they're particularly mean for flats. We have an odd thing in this country that we assume that flats will be smaller, pokier and nastier than houses, and actually it should be the other way around. Precisely because if you live in a flatter development, you're in a more urban environment, you generally don't have your own front door or a garden, it's all the more important that your living space has really decent spatial standards inside. And certainly that's true in a lot of countries, whereas in this country, we actually our flats are smaller and worse quality. And then we wonder why people dislike flats, and the aspiration, the culture becomes very much about, you know, your own house with a front door, which drives a kind of suburban, low density, car dependent model of development, which ultimately doesn't work for us.
But on space standards, I mean, the book that we wrote in the end suggested that if you put them up by 20%, it wouldn't do that much damage to the land values. Do you think 20% would be too much, or should you just muck around with the flats?
No, 20% would be fine. I mean, like I say, you could argue about the number. I'd quite happily probably see them higher still. How many people can really say that their house is just vastly too big and their kids just have way too much room? We could all do with a bit more living space. The balance there is, for my mind, not about land values. That's not the constraining factor. I would like space standards and other quality factors to be pushing down land values. Land values are too high in this country. The constraining factor is just that if the space involved in homes gets so large that it actually lowers overall urban densities to the point where public services become strained. And we're a very, very long way off that, because where there's so much wasted public space, mainly for roads and car uses, that we could quite easily improve the internal space standards dramatically while increasing urban densities. In fact, I would say that increasing space standards is a necessary part of increasing urban densities.
Well Fantastic. Said, sir. Well said.
Thank you, Toby.
One of the things you did for us, and when we interviewed you for our book, was you introduced us to the idea of repealing the 1961 Act, and you've already referred to this on a couple of occasions. Can you unpack that a bit for us, Toby? Because you were so luminous about it at the time.
Yeah, this is one of those incredibly kind of technical, rather hidden factors that we eventually alighted on as being absolutely central to the problem of the land market. And the problem is simply that land values inevitably, in a free trading capitalist economy which allows for untrammeled private property in land, it is an absolute iron law of economics and was recognized as such since the days of Adam Smith, that economic value will collect in land value. That is not helpful for the economy as a whole, because it encourages people to speculate on an unproductive asset. It encourages people to actually reduce their entrepreneurialism and just use whatever access to capital they have, whether it's their own or borrowed, to simply bid up the price of existing property. And as Adam Smith put it, it has a kind of moral problem, because it encourages people to not bother working, because you can make more from speculating on property. So it's both unproductive and it's immoral.
It is the case, isn't it, that people have earned more on their house value than they do in their salaries. So it's quite an extraordinary fact.
That is the case, except I wouldn't use the word earn. Because, of course, if your house has gone up in value, that's very rarely because you've earned it. It's just because society as a whole, whether it's through the provision of infrastructure, overall economic growth, changing cultural attitudes, you know, or even kind of mineral discoveries or whatever, society as a whole has generated value that has simply collated into the form of property values. And that's an extreme, that's what the economists call economic rent. It is inherently extractive. And it's not productive. So that's why kind of liberals like Adam Smith were very keen to try and drive out economic rent, because they thought it was immoral and wasteful. But in housing terms, what it means, what it looks like, is that some people make more money from just watching their houses go up in value than they do from going to work, while other people see an ever larger proportion of their income being spent on just paying the rent or the mortgage to somebody else. Yeah, if the aim is to try and eliminate or at least reduce economic rent, then in practical terms, that means you need to have some mechanism for preventing economic rent accumulating in property. Now, Adam Smith and other classical liberals preferred tax levers for that. So they advocated land value taxes as a way of capturing that economic value. And that is certainly the one to say that a lot of economists prefer. There are a lot of practical problems with, certainly political problems with trying to use taxation to capture economic rent in the form of housing, not least because you've got to levy a pretty hefty cash tax on something that doesn't actually, it may be generating value, but it's not generating cash every year. So there are genuine barriers to pure land value tax. I'm personally a big advocate of having a tax system that does do a bit more work of keeping property values down and capturing land value for the public benefit. But in and of itself, it's not enough. You will always need other interventions to control the supply of land coming into the system in order to prevent this kind of speculative ratchet effect, squeezing everything else out. And that's where compulsory purchase comes in. So this is a long-winded way of saying why we need compulsory purchase reform. It feels like a marginal case, but it's not, because ultimately the price of land is determined by whoever is the highest bidder for it in a free trading economy. When you have a fixed supply of land, and there will always be a fixed supply of land, you know, some people might blame the planning system for this, but it's the other way around. The land supply is fixed. That's why we have a planning system to regulate its use. When you have a fixed supply of land and anyone can bid up the price of it, inevitably the price is going to go up. And ultimately, as people like Smith noted, that will extract all of the value from, or too much of the value from, the rest of the productive economy. That pushes up the price to the point where no one can afford to do anything good with that land. And that's what we see now. We see developers who find that to buy land, they have to outbid each other. And how do they outbid each other? By cutting corners on all the costs that they're going to spend, by making aggressive assumptions about how much they can sell the homes for, and then they absolutely have to get those high prices at the end, and by cutting every possible corner in terms of the quality, the space standards, the affordable housing, the infrastructure. And the result is that before anyone has even applied for planning permission, let alone actually started laying bricks, you've already determined that the quality of the homes, the quality of the overall place you're building, will be as low as possible, and the land price will be as high as possible. The only way around that is for the state to intervene in the supply of land through compulsory purchase.
Just before we go on to the future, which will be about Labour, who are looking to do CPOing, as you perhaps know, you were getting quite close to getting some quite good things done at number 10. What actually happened to puncture it?
I don't think it's giving away any massive political secrets to say that was a fairly chaotic period in government. It was the height of the Brexit crisis. The government of the day had very little bandwidth, had very little ability to make any kind of long-term plans. The problems we're talking about in housing here are deep and structural. Ideally, you'd want 20 years to reform the tax system, the benefit system, the planning system, you know, infrastructure supply. This was a government that was never quite sure if it was going to last another month. So there was no point in starting that sort of thing, even if I'd had everyone in government in agreement with me, and I very much didn't. You know, I had a few minutes every couple of months with the Prime Minister, a bit more every couple of weeks maybe with Gavin Barwell. There was no way you were going to launch that sort of structural reform. So it was a matter of just finding little things you could do in a hurry.
I always got the sense that you and Gavin Barwell were kindred spirits, and certainly Gavin Barwell was the first, in my experience, the first housing minister to actually admit that the housing market was broken. And I thought that in itself was worth hanging on to. Can I ask you a bit of a leading question here, Toby, and you don't have to answer it if you don't want to. Would you welcome the chance to go back in again into central government to give it another go?
Absolutely. I mean, it was an extraordinary experience. And even being a bit of an oddball in a fairly chaotic government in very challenging times, which had very little political capital, very little time and very little kind of bandwidth, even in those inauspicious circumstances, I achieved more to improve the housing system in 14 months there than I did in 7 years campaigning from shelter, because there's just no substitute for being closer to the levers. So yeah, if you want to make the system better, it's the only place you can do it from.
Toby, can we move on now to the present day? And Jackie and I have been talking to these people, and we keep coming down to the same ineluctable conclusions about what could be done. And the ineluctable conclusion is you have to build council houses again at scale. That seems to be from right across the spectrum, right from house builders to people who've been in government, are all beginning to say the same thing now. What's your view on it?
My view is a little more nuanced than that, in that I think it's very clear that you'll never get the homes we need without significant public intervention, particularly on the land supply. And you then also need to have developers who are acting in the public interest, broadly defined, who have access to long-term capital and are going to be there and have an interest for the long term, and therefore have an interest in the long-term quality, not only of the homes, but of the places, and are able to coordinate with infrastructure providers, other service providers, etc. Now, that definition clearly can be met by the state doing it directly itself in the form of council housing. But it doesn't have to be. It could also be done through, you know, housing associations can meet that definition too. So can philanthropic public bodies. If we look at the history of the greatest place we've built in the last few hundred years in this country, you know, look at, Poundbury is probably the most recent high quality place built. That was by, you know, a private body owned by the Prince of Wales, because he had a bee in his bonnet about the nature of architecture, right? That was a form of public interest. He had access to the land, he had access to the capital, to the borrowing potential because, you know, the banks are there. So actually, it doesn't have to be the state. It's just that if you're looking for a definition of an organisation that can do all those things, the state's the obvious place to go.
I think what I'm talking about is very, very narrow, a very narrow idea, which is not about housing in general. It's about council housing or public rental homes, as Jackie and I called them, rather slyly, because we didn't want to call them council houses. There seems to be a view around that. Forget the rest of the housing market. That sort of will take care of itself. But something needs to be done about building houses for the 6.2 million households who cannot afford more than about 100 quid a week in rent. Now, then the question becomes, well, who should be in charge of this? How should it be done? And a couple of days ago, Jackie can tell you about, we spoke to somebody who thought that the way forward would have to be via government intervention. So Jackie can talk about that, can't you? You understood it better than I did.
Well, Toby, it kind of goes back to your rather incisive contribution to a debate on Newsnight, where I was sort of sitting there slumbering over my cup of tea, and all of a sudden you bounce onto the television screen and actually talked about the last time we didn't have a housing crisis, which was, of course, in the late 70s. And I thought you put it very, very well when you said the last time we didn't have a housing crisis was when the state were directly involved.
I can explain a tiny bit more as to what I'm thinking. So the idea really is the thing that we produced for Localis suggested that it should be a site-by-site appraisal, and that councils should be taking the lead in the sense that it would be politically for them to push to get their council house waiting list down. So this programme would be sold on the basis that councils would be able to get their council house waiting list down. And into the mix would go grants and land from government for free. Obviously the grants are free, but the land would have to go in for free. And then our model was a mix of council and private. But I'm beginning to think that that's just going to complicate things. And it would be far better if councils just built council houses on land that they owned or the state owned, and that the land value thing would be sorted out by grants to bring it to zero. Your views, really?
I mean, yeah, in many ways, that is the simple and traditional way in which councils built a lot of housing in the kind of 50s and 60s. I mean, the downside to it is simply that monotenure estates are now generally felt to not be a particularly ideal solution for places, that it's better for communities as a whole to have more of a mixture of different types of people, with different income spectrum profiles and the like, and therefore, you know, having a mixture of different tenures is helpful. But yeah, I mean, essentially that model is still alive and it's just not very well. You know,
no.
Half the councils in the country still have a housing revenue account. There is a multi-£1 billion grant program every year. It's just that the details of what they're allowed to do with their land, the details of how much grant they can get, the details of which bits of land are available, and no longer as well aligned as they have been in the past. But yeah, the basic concept is still exactly the same as it always has been. Building houses is not a kind of brain surgery type operation where the fundamentals change dramatically from one decade to another. It's still essentially the same process of buying land and piling some bricks on it, right?
You can tell we're both completely inexpert in this housing revenue grant stuff. But could you just tell us, just expand a little bit on how it could be made to work better?
Well, we already have a multi-£1 billion program of grants. The problem, firstly, at the moment, is that these grants are het about by all sorts of rules, mainly from the Treasury, who's quite keen on when they're forced to allocate money to spend on things they don't particularly like social housing. They then come up with a million ways of stopping you spending it and clawing it back. So Michael Gove has just had to give back £2 billion to the Treasury in unspent housing grants. So the first thing to do is just to allow the money that's already been allocated for this purpose to be actually spent. So, for example, there's been massive cost inflation across the board, particularly on building cost inputs. Does the grant rate go up to reflect that? No. So suddenly people find that they can't actually spend the grant they have got because the Treasury says you're only allowed to pay a certain amount for bricks, which is just mad. The price of bricks has gone up. Right. So some of this is just simple. Just spend the money you've already got. Other bits are a bit more sophisticated. So you know, there are problems with the way that the grant and the land and the planning permission line up, where, you know, your call for a more traditional, simplistic way of doing it would be quite welcome. There's absolutely no reason why councils, charities, housing associations, hell, well-intentioned philanthropic or stewardship landowners. There's plenty of opportunity for private business to be doing good quality development. It's just that they don't tend to want to because they can make more money out of a quick speculative turn than they can from the long-term building of quality.
But isn't the problem with involving the private sector and having multi-tenure estates that you rely upon the sale of the private houses before you get the affordable? And as it's happened in the last 12 months, of course, it's all, you know, everything slowed down because the private isn't selling.
Yes, that's a sequencing problem.
Surely in small paces, in small areas, up to 50 or 60 houses and councils, it could be done, couldn't it, without too much fuss?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And some councils are building homes on exactly that sort of level, and housing associations, more to the point, are building lots like that. So, you know, yes, of course we could do more of that. But your point about the involvement of the private sector and the public sector together is just one of sequencing. The problem is not the idea that they can both play a role. They always have. And actually, where it works well, it's a positive symbiotic relationship. During that kind of glory days of house building, you often had a lot of small local builders who would take contracts from the council and build a few speculatively for private sale themselves. That meant that if the market turned down, they weren't selling so well, fine. They didn't go bust because they could just keep doing the kind of low margin contractor work for the council. And in good years, maybe they made a few extra quid, which allowed them to buy another field themselves. So, you know, there was a symbiotic relationship between the public and the private. Whereas now we've managed to do it the other way around so that we expect the private sector to go out and take a lot of risk buying sites. Then we try and screw them for some Section 106 money to cross-subsidise affordable housing later in the process, which means that if you don't get one, you don't get the other. You know, so it's gone from being kind of symbiotic to being a parasitic relationship.
Hi, Chloe here again. You're listening to Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast. We'll be back to Jackie and Peter in a moment. But first, a reminder, you can gain access to all the content on building.co.uk or housingtoday.co.uk by going to our websites and clicking subscribe. Now, back to Jackie and Peter.
Can I ask you about where you think we are in terms of the politics of the words council housing? Recently, an industry lunch, and I'm talking about some fairly old dyed-in-the-wool behemoths from the property development industry, there was a consensus around the table of about 20 people that we needed the wholesale re-emergence of council housing. Where do you think we are politically in terms of what the opposition, who are going to become the government, what their stance on? I mean, it's all very well them shouting build, 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 but we haven't seen any of the detail. Where do you think they are politically in terms of the language?
I mean, they certainly talk about council housing far more than has been traditional for a long time. I think in reality, once they get into power, they'll find that remember, fewer than half the councils in the country have a council housing function anymore, as in they have transferred all of their council housing stock to housing associations. So any kind of narrow focus that says, oh, we're only interested in council housing, not housing association housing, is going to exclude half the country on day one. And it's also, more to the point, it's just pointless. They're essentially the same. They're doing the same function. Now, they have the slight differences, and I'm personally a believer in having quite a diverse ecosystem. I see no reason why you have to put all your eggs in one basket. I think we need housing associations, we need councils. I'd add community-led models of affordable housing as well. There are multiple different versions, even within the kind of social housing, public housing space, all of which have a role to play. And I don't think we should be uptight about which one it is. In some places, great, you've got a council that owns land and has got a housing development function, crack on. In other places, work with your local housing association.
So what words would you, if we're not going to use the words council housing, and we've seemed to struggle with social housing and affordable housing, what words would you use to try and, we're trying to make a breakthrough here. We're trying to, you know, we're trying to convince the public that we need a different strategy. What words would you use?
Yeah, I'm not sure I've got the answer for you here. It's something we did wrestle with a lot at Shelter because social housing had become a bit of a kind of, seen to be a bit of a failed brand. On the other hand, that is the accurate description for what we're talking about. because it covers both council and housing association owned properties, it refers to the tenure, socially rented housing. The term affordable housing was originally a perfectly valid term because it covered both social rented housing and the other type of submarket homes, namely kind of shared ownership, low cost home ownership models, which again is useful because I think we do need an intermediate kind of middle market option as well. Unfortunately, the term affordable then got so thoroughly abused by the creation of affordable rent, which is, you know, just muddied the waters, confused everyone to the point where if you say the word affordable in a lot of places, people's eyes roll and they kind of reach for their revolvers. So, you know, the language has got really, really messy. I think the only solution actually is that we just have to go back to basics and just call it social housing because that's what it is.
I just wanted to get your views on two things that Labour have said. One is that they're going to bulldoze the planning system, which is an amusing thought. And secondly, they're going to build 1.5 million homes in the first 5 years of their tenure. And thirdly, they seem very keen on new towns. So those seem to be things that they were all very keen on back in 2002, 2004. And ended up with the 2004 Planning Act. It seems like they haven't learnt anything since last time around, and they don't seem to have people around them that understand precisely what will happen when they try to do what they did last time, which was it never worked. I don't know how close you are to Labour, but just your views on what they think they're going to be doing.
I do talk to Labour a lot. Firstly, this is an election year. There is a big difference between what you say to win an election and a programme for government. They are just different
shocking,
things. And, you know, we have a political culture in this country and a media-led culture, which is deeply unhelpful in this regard. Everyone is just looking for a headline. No one bothers to even read the article beneath it, let alone the kind of analysis that goes behind that. And then they just want to trip you up as a politician. So we shouldn't be surprised that we have politicians who just stick to glib lines without any deeper commitments, because actually that's what we demand of them. And if they have the temerity to go further and actually set out a detailed program with significant policy proposals in it, we tear them to shreds, or we call them boring, right? So don't be surprised if what you get is cheap headlines that don't really mean anything. That's just the nature of our political culture. Beneath that, though, I think there is a lot more thinking. If you actually read the text of what came out during the Labour Party conference from Angela Rayner and from Matthew Pennycook, the Shadow Housing Minister, and from Keir Starmer himself, it did add up to an agenda that was based on reforming the planning system in order to drive more value out of the land and actually, you know, get the system working for public benefit better, because I think everyone recognises it really isn't anymore. And a commitment to building more homes overall, which is absolutely shared with the current government, by the way, that 1.5 million homes you may notice is exactly the same as the current government's 300,000 homes a year. You know, it may not be a fully detailed programme yet, but you wouldn't expect that before an election. But the headlines are broadly what you would want to see, i.e. commitment to building more homes, making more of them genuinely affordable, and a recognition that planning has to do more of the heavy.
But it's not going to happen, is it?
Why
you think they'll build 1.5 million houses in 5 years?
It's ambitious, but it's certainly not impossible.
Pete is always the pessimist and I'm always a bit more of an optimist. I'm very reassured by what you've just said there, Toby, because I'm not surprised that you're speaking to the Labour Party opinion formers and decision makers all the time. And actually, you've reassured me. There's an awful lot more detail there than certainly I'd perceived. I love the tone and the approach. I mean, I loved the build, build, build speech. I thought it was absolutely excellent. I couldn't see where the beef is. If you're telling me that there is beef, it's just being kept, you know, the cards being kept close to the chest, then you've made me feel much, much happier.
Well, I think there's a lot of work going on. The other thing to say, of course, is that political parties in general, and Labour in particular, are complex organisms. They're not even organisms, they're ecosystems. There's lots of different people who have different views. When I was in government, I was always asked this question: what does the government think of this? As though there was this kind of perfectly formed crystalline structure where everything made sense that we just hadn't bothered to share with you. So, you know, I've got five different contradictory ideas and I'm just one small part of the machine. You know, of course government doesn't have a single clear idea, nor does the opposition.
Can I just come back a bit? I mean, I read the text of the Lord Mayor's lecture given by the Shadow Chancellor the other day and nearly wept. I mean, I was involved with the Smith Institute back in 2000 and 2005, where we produced all sorts of monographs on housing. I got very involved with the Kate Barker Review. We had all these seminars at number 11. You may have attended some of them, I don't know. And all I'm seeing is the Brownite solution that planning needs to be reformed in order to kickstart the economy. And then they tried very hard to do it. They spent huge amounts of time reforming the planning system to absolutely no effect. And why would it be any different this time?
Firstly, I agree with you that just saying the words planning reform doesn't achieve anything. You need to know planning reform in what direction. I think it's just election posturing. They're trying to ride the kind of YIMBY horse of just blaming the planning system. And you know, don't forget, of course, liberalisation has a great advantage of not costing anything. So in the kind of absurd fiscal rules game that we have to play in this country, you don't have to charge that as a cost. So you can just say it'll generate growth without any investment, which is daft. But there you go. The key question will be, what does planning reform actually mean? And so far, the third point that you raised, Peter, that Labour have talked about is new towns. Now, that for me is the critical one, because that's where you reveal that planning reform doesn't just mean liberalisation. Liberalisation gets you more speculation, more overpriced land, more lower quality homes, and probably not even more homes overall in reality, because we've seen that with every turn of the boom bust speculative driven house building model we go through, we actually end up building fewer in the long run. So it doesn't even work on its own terms. The reference to new towns tells you that actually what we mean by planning reform here is more proactive planning. It means government actually saying there will be homes in this location. And that's what planning reform really means. It means, well, actually what most people, if you talk to most people who are not involved in the sector, what is the planning system? They imagine it means government with a big map, kind of drawing circles on the map saying that's what's going to go there. Most people are quite horrified to discover that actually it's just a long-winded kind of waffly document that says, oh, we might think about this if you come forward and suggest something, right? Planning is meant to be, you know, spatial planning. It's meant to be the public sector acting in the public interest to say this is what should be built and this is where it's going to go and this is what it'll look like and this is, you know, how it'll connect to the next town along, right? And that's what I think the reference to new towns demonstrates, that when they're talking about planning reform, they're talking about doing actually more planning, not less.
Yeah, I can see the new towns thing working. I'll shut up in a minute, Jackie. You can have the last word. We're coming towards the end now. It's just my bugbear, this one. Yeah, this 1.5 million houses in 5 years isn't going to happen, and they are going to be blamed for it not happening. So why in God's name did they say it in the first place? And the reason I say that is that's history, folks. But also, even if you start planning the new towns the day they get in, and even if you've CPO'd the land by the end of the first year, it'll be 5 years before you've built anything, won't it? The timing issues are all wrong, aren't they, on this process? They're promising things they cannot deliver.
If we're just playing the game of headline statements and targets, yeah, of course you never meet them. That's not really the point there, is it? The point is to, you know, if we did manage to build 300,000 homes a year or 1.5 million homes over 5 years, it's not like we could all give up and go home and problem solved. These are just indications of the direction of travel. Now, that's the way our political system works, that we obsess about these things, just like we obsess about abstract fiscal rules. I mean, you know, what difference does it make if the OBR says that in 5 years' time, the proportion of debt to GDP is projected to be falling slightly? How on earth does that relate to the fundamental issue of the fiscal sustainability of the public finances? It doesn't at all. But that's the game we're playing. So we're playing a game about 1.5 million homes. Now, if you want to play that game, fine. You can say they won't meet it. Does it matter if we're a few homes over or under? No, it doesn't. The point is we need to be reforming the way that we build housing. And if that's the lever that you need to drive the system to do things better, so be it.
This is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast.
Toby, you know, you're a breath of fresh air, and you'll have to forgive the curmudgeonly old man that I have to work with, you know. I mean, you know, you only get him every so often. I have to work with him day in, day out. I'm super grateful to you for your time today. You've been so generous. We always end our interviews by asking people the magic wand question, which is, if I gave you a magic wand and said to you you could do one thing, now this is quite hard, Toby, particularly for you, one thing that would ameliorate the housing crisis, what would it be?
Well, normally when people ask me this question, I refer to the Land Compensation Act and improving the capacity purchase system. But we've already done that, so I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say anything really controversial or really annoy you. We should be banning cars from new developments.
Do you know what, Toby? You may have started World War III between me and Pete, because that's a conversation he and I have all the time. And I have to say, the idea that we are building great big housing estates to bake in car dependency just kills me, and it kills me all the time.
They're not housing estates. They're not housing estates. We're basically building car parks and roads with some fairly crummy accommodation spaces tacked on the edges.
Well said. Well said, Toby. Thank you very much indeed for your time today. You've been fantastic. Thank you very much indeed for pushing back on Peter Bill, which is the greatest thing ever. We're always grateful to you. We've been watching your exploits with the Office for Place and all the other things that you're involved in at the moment. And it's wonderful to see you going from strength to strength. Thank you very much indeed, Toby.
Thanks, Toby.
All the best.
This is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast.
Well, once again, he's blown me away. I have to say, one of the things I hadn't quite taken on was what a great campaigner he is. I mean, the whole idea of working in shelter, which I guess is an ideologically driven organisation, if ever there was one, and him actually presenting policy in a way that would endear shelter policy to the Conservative Party, so much so that he even changed the colour of the documents, you know, the cover of the documents from red to a nice barber green, as he put it. I mean, those little insights into what a terrifically brilliant campaigner he is, I think they were well worth having.
He also suggested that the planning system could be changed. I wasn't convinced by his defence of that argument. And I think...
Well, what he wasn't saying was that if they're going to go for a number of new towns, they're going to need development corporations for those new towns. That was the very careful thing he wasn't saying.
Yeah.
That would be the planning reform he's talking about. When he talks about people sitting in a room with felt pens saying that's going to go there and that's going to go there, this is top-down development corporation planning. And I have to say, I'm cheering in the aisles about that.
Well, I suppose that's what they're going to do. But the idea that one single house will be built in the first 5 years in these new towns is nonsense. I think perhaps the most heartening part of Toby's analysis was that he gets it when it comes to land values and the importance of the extraction or non-extraction of values by developers or not.
Well, Pete, that was another illuminating afternoon. What to say? I mean, I'm going away with my head buzzing. Thank you very much indeed, and see you next time. Bye-bye.
It's terrific, as it always is, talking with you, Jackie, and also having somebody that we're both talking to that's clever on both of us. That's nice, isn't it?
Well, it wouldn't be hard enough.
No, true. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast. More from Jackie and Peter next Tuesday. And a final reminder that you can gain access to all of our content on building.co.uk or housingtoday.co.uk by going to the websites and clicking subscribe. Goodbye for now.